to talk to you about blood and the blood vascular system. When we start at the heart, which is a living muscular pump, blood is driven from the left side of the heart into the largest artery of the body, called the aorta. And the aorta extends upwards and then towards the left and then downwards through the chest cavity and abdominal cavity. It's a large vessel. In a big man, it probably is more than an inch in diameter. And then as it reaches the pelvis, it divides into right and left branches. And very shortly, each of those branches divide into two branches. One going into the depths of the pelvis and the other going down the limb. And of course, from the arch of the aorta, and that's what we call the part that comes out of the heart, arches over to the left and then goes down and the back area of the chest behind the lungs, come out three major branches. One going to the right arm, one going to the left arm. Two of those come out together. And then we have two large vessels running up to the brain on the right and left side, the carotid arteries. Now, arteries are thick-walled, and they carry blood under pressure. Veins are vessels that are thin-walled and carry blood under very little pressure. Now, the arteries keep dividing and become smaller and smaller until ultimately they become capillaries. The capillary is the smallest blood vessel. And if you took an ordinary straight pin and you lined up longitudinally 700 capillaries, they would comfortably fit into the shaft of an ordinary pin. They are actually so small that the red blood cells have to go through them single file. And a red blood cell isn't a very large structure. And of course, the Creator designed this. As they have to line up to go through single file, they go through slowly and they have an opportunity of releasing their oxygen and picking up their carbon dioxide, the hemoglobin in the red blood cells. In the lungs, the environment of the vessel and the air sac is alkaline. The carbon dioxide is released from the hemoglobin in an alkaline environment. And hemoglobin grabs onto oxygen in an alkaline environment. In the environment of the capillary, the environment is acid. And in an acid environment, hemoglobin has a hard time holding onto hemoglobin, so it lets go of hemoglobin and it grabs onto carbon dioxide. And so hemoglobin is really a very remarkable molecule. And I have a few slides where I want to show you how the body puts together hemoglobin. And it also illustrates certain other things that I'd like to share with you. So if we can have the lights out now, I'll move over and try to describe in words the things we'll see on the chart. I call this the hemoglobin assembly line. And starting here to our left is a word called succinate. Succinate it's a type of carbohydrate. And below it is glycine. Glycine is the most common and simplest of all the amino acids. And as you know, a group of amino acids go together to form proteins. So, in essence, we have a carbohydrate and we have a part of a protein, and these are put together to form a substance called porphobilinogen. And I have given it a shape here. I hope those of you at the back can see it. It's a little wedge with a point directed downwards. I don't know what shape porphobilinogen is, but this is the shape I told the artist to make it. And then you get four porphobilinogen molecules and arrange them with their points directed towards one another, and you get a little Maltese cross. And that substance is called protoporphyrin III. Now I'm skipping many intermediate steps. These are the major ones. Then one atom of iron is put into the center of the protoporphyrin III molecule to form heme. Now coming from in the blood, from the liver, is sort of a giant molecule, globin. Globin is made up of more than 500 amino acids, each one arranged in a specific sequence. If one of those is out of sequence, you run into trouble. And then four heme molecules attach themselves to the globin molecule, and we get hemoglobin. This is the pigment that carries oxygen from the lungs to the tissues and carries back carbon dioxide from the tissues to the lungs. Now we'll get a little further into it. Nothing happens in the body by chance. Nothing floats into the body, nothing floats out of the body. As we'll tell you tomorrow morning, even your thoughts are the end product of electrochemical activity in living cells, the neurons. And each thought is the end product of a series of enzyme actions. Now, an enzyme is a workman. It is a protein molecule, highly specialized. Each enzyme can just do one thing. And if it takes three steps to put succinate and glycine together to make porphobilinogen, then there are three enzymes. They may be even more if they're intermediate steps, but I'm just taking the big steps here. Then it takes six enzyme steps to arrange four porphobilinogen molecules in the arrangement of this cross. And then it takes one enzyme step to insert the atom of iron into the molecule of protoporphyrin III to form heme. Now, the attachment of heme to globin is not an enzyme reaction, it is a chemical reaction. And so these four heme molecules chemically orientate themselves and attach themselves to the globin molecule to give you hemoglobin. Now, workmen need tools. I'm sort of a maybe jack of all trades. I like to work with my hands. I earned my living or earned part of my way through medical course by building houses and cabinets and shingling roofs. And I have in my garage and my tool arrangement, I have tools to do woodworking. I have a table saw and a jointer. I have a drill press. I have tools to do plumbing. I have tools to do electric wiring. I'm not much of an automobile mechanic, so I don't have many of those. My wife is a better automobile mechanic than I am. But you know, she has sewing machines. She has various things in the kitchen. These tools facilitate carrying out the jobs of life. It's no different to the enzyme workmen. They need tools. And the tools that enzyme workmen require are vitamins and minerals. That is the role of vitamins and minerals. They are the tools for the enzyme workmen to accomplish their task. Now, as we mentioned, here there's just one enzyme. But here there are several enzymes, and where there are several enzymes that carry out an activity in sequence, we call that an enzyme system. This is a smaller enzyme system than is this one. This is just a single enzyme reaction. Now, these enzymes here require pantothenic acid and pyridoxine, these are two of the B vitamins, and they require potassium and phosphorus. Now, if it was bigger, I could tell you which each one required. Some may need all three, some may need one. Now, these three vitamins here provide the tools for these six enzymes. And to insert the atom of iron into the protoporphyrin III molecule, this one enzyme needs copper and vitamin C. You can readily see, as I point out to the students, that if you have an anemia, an iron deficiency anemia, you may have plenty of iron, but you may not have copper or vitamin C. Or you may not have any of these or any of these. If anywhere down the line there is a lack, the end product of heme will not be produced. And you're going to get an anemia. We emphasize iron. Iron is the thing that is emphasized the greatest, but I don't know whether that is the most important element that needs to be taken. Now, it helps a lot of people. But this points out that anywhere along this assembly line, if there is a lack or deficiency, you will end up with a deficiency of the end product. If the liver is shorted with some of these amino acids, you won't get globin, or you won't get as many globin molecules, and you'll run into an anemia. So you just can't focus on one thing. Now I'd like to ask a sort of rhetorical question. I have, hanging on the wall in my, where I keep my tools, or some of the tools, I have three hammers. But I only use one at a time. I have not developed the ability to hammer with a hammer in my left hand and another one in my right. Now, a hammer to me is absolutely essential in, say, fabricating a shed or a room onto my house or an attic. Would it make me any more efficient if I had 15 hammers? No. As long as I have one good hammer, that's all I need. The more hammers I have, the more space they occupy, and the greater problems they use. The reason I have three hammers is this. My wife sometimes borrows one. And then I look for my hammer and it's not there. And the other one, someone just didn't want an extra hammer and they gave it to me, and so I hung it up on the wall. But I'm quite satisfied by having just one hammer. And this is true with vitamins and minerals. Just taking lots of vitamins and minerals isn't going to make the enzymes work any more efficiently. If they have what they need, more is just going to be a problem. And certainly the principle in nutrition is enough is enough. It is throughout the body. Overloading will never facilitate any activity. You see, this assembly line here goes on in the bone marrow. And the cells that do all these things, it happens within cells. Those cells in which heme is produced will not absorb vitamins and minerals that are in the blood if they don't need it. And it makes a drag on the kidneys and the liver that have to eliminate these things. See, you can drink carrot juice till your skin gets yellow. They call it carotenemia. Have any of you had carotenemia? Your skin, the hands look yellow, and someone looks at you, you don't look well. You look like you've got jaundice. Well, the difference is the white of your eyes don't turn yellow in carotenemia. In jaundice they do, and that's a differentiating part. But you've just overloaded the body so much the liver can't handle it, the kidneys can't handle it, and so the third kidney, the skin, is called into function to try to get rid of it. Now, we don't see the problems of some of the other vitamins when we take in the massive doses, but this is what goes on. All you can do is use them. Now, this is how enzymes use vitamins and minerals. Now, I'm not showing all of the vitamins and minerals that are used in these in this particular illustration. But we say here, this is a substrate. Now, the substrate is the raw materials. It's the lumber with which a house is going to be built. So here you have the substrate here, and this you, and enzymes are kept in sort of two or more pieces, as it were. They stay apart until they want to accomplish their task. And this is called an apoenzyme, and this is called a coenzyme. And these two unite here, and they catch hold of this lumber, as it were, here. And then they break that lumber apart. Here are the products. They've broken that molecule into two molecules now. And then the enzyme here, or the enzyme complex, breaks apart and you have it again, right as it is here, to do that task again. See, each one just does one thing. So here is some lumber coming along, and the coenzyme and apoenzyme unite, each one attaches to part of that thing, and then they pull it apart, and so you get the two products here, and then these two split apart and wait to do another job. They do it over and over again. And to accomplish this, you need certain vitamins and minerals. This is where they function. And the enzyme isn't used up in the reaction, nor are its tools. It's like I have a board, I'm going to make some shelves or something else, and I want the strips to put the facing on, and I run the board through my table saw. The table saw is the enzyme. It splits the board. The table saw doesn't become part of the shelf. Neither do I. And so the products are here, and these are ready to do it over and over again. Now, here's another illustration. That's one. These are three different ways that we can't see enzymes. We can see certain molecules through the electron microscope. Here again is the same lumber, as I say. But here is an apoenzyme, and here is a coenzyme. And you see the coenzyme, this grabs hold of the lumber, and the coenzyme goes and straightens it out, and then it breaks it apart, and these two are ready to do it over again, and the same thing is here. You see, the enzyme has to be able to fit the particular piece of the substrate or the lumber. And you see a drug, a chemical that is foreign to the economy of your body. The only reason it has any kind of reaction or response in the body is part of it fits into an enzyme. And sometimes this drug will fit into either the apoenzyme or the coenzyme or both, and then it won't release it. It inactivates the enzyme. And then, of course, you have a problem, because that particular function is no longer being carried out by the body, and you may get a deficiency, you may get some breakdown of tissue. So here is where vitamins and minerals are used, and I thought the illustration of the illustration of the formation of heme does it very, very nicely. So, of course, heme and the hemoglobin molecule are extremely important when we come to our bloodstream. Now, if we can have the light, our arterial systems, with the blood contained therein, are the major transportation system of the body. You know, we have canals in certain parts of this country, and in Europe they have canals. Most countries have canals. Canals are waterways. And our transportation system within the body is a waterway. And the blood fills those waterways. Now, it's very fascinating to me to know that our arteries and veins are full of blood all the time. It's chock-a-block full. And no air bubbles or anything like that. It's full. Now, when the heart pumps blood, it pumps it out into an arterial system that is already full of blood. Now, the heart doesn't contract slowly like that. When the heart contracts, it contracts like a gun firing, explosively. Only about 3/10 of a second, and the heart has contracted. And it ejects, actually shoots out a ball of blood that may be as much as half or more of a cup, into an arterial system that is already full of blood. So what happens? As the heart contracts, that ball of blood is ejected into the aorta, and the aorta expands. And immediately after the heart contracts, it relaxes. And that blood wants to go right back into the heart from where it came. But a valve snaps shut. And it's imprisoned now in the aorta. And the muscles of the aortic wall now contract and milk that ball of blood down the arterial tree. But you know, the heart is beating at least 60 times a minute. So within a second, another ball of blood has come, and another ball, and another ball, and another ball. And of course, if you're running, and you're exercising, and your heart is beating 120 times a minute, you have balls of blood shooting into that artery every half second. And you see, this is what exercises and strengthens the blood vessels. So you see, when you exercise your muscles, you accelerate the action of the heart. And not only does the heart speed up, but it begins to eject more blood per beat. It dilates, so it accepts more blood and pushes more blood out. In fact, it may double the amount of blood per beat. And then you double the rate of beating. So the amount of blood that is pushed out when you're exercising is enormous. Now the vein, the blood, the arterial blood carries not only the oxygen on the hemoglobin, but it transports all the vital substances you get from your food or those that are manufactured from your hormones, the endocrine glands. So fragments of food, the amino acids, the fatty acids, the sugars, these are being circulated, plus those that are being put out by the endocrine glands, the hormones, and these are surging around the body. The blood goes through from one end of your body to another at least once a minute. And as it passes the different cells, we talked about the bone marrow here, where the heme is made. Those cells that make the heme take the iron they need, they take the vitamins they need, they take any other raw materials, the carbohydrate, the glycine, and the succinate, and those enzyme systems put it together and form the heme, which is then put into the bloodstream, or the globin comes along from the liver. They unite together and the hemoglobin is put into the bloodstream or into the red blood cells, and then the red blood cells are ejected into the bloodstream. Now, an average length of life of a red blood cell is 120 days, 3 months. And while I've been talking to you today, this morning, every second, the average healthy person, 2 to 3 million red blood cells are taken off into the wrecking yards. And 2 to 3 million brand new red blood cells are being ejected from your bone marrow into your bloodstream to replace those. So every second, our bone marrow and liver together are producing enough hemoglobin to produce 2 to 3 million red blood cells every second. Now that's a lot. These are the whole red blood cells. But now each red blood cell has over 300 million hemoglobin molecules. Each red blood cell has over 300 million hemoglobin molecules. And each of those hemoglobin molecules has 4 heme molecules. Now who are the mathematicians here? You multiply 4 by 300 million by 3 million. And you have 900 million, million, million heme molecules every second. Every second. Now if you give a transfusion, the speed will be increased because now you need more. So a message goes out to these manufacturing factories and they'll produce more. Now this is only one substance of one cell. There are other areas of the body where things are being produced as fast or even faster to replace the lining of your mucosa of the stomach and intestines, to replace the skin cells that are wearing off. And if we could just have insight and could look into the human body and see the fantastic activity of every system, and the enormous rate at which it goes, and the precision with which it works, and the control systems that exist, my mind just boggles. And I, like the psalmist, say, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Now, the blood also carries white blood cells. And a whole array of white blood cells. And these white blood cells form the police force and the army of the body. You know, if you were an enemy trying to enter the body, you have an enormous defense system to meet. The skin is a barrier. The mucous membrane is a barrier. But then if you can somehow get through that mechanical barrier, then you run into chemical warfare, where all types of armaments are thrown at you. And Dr. Calvin mentioned to you the other day our immune system and the T cells and the B cells and all the other phagocytes that are there to defend us against the invasion of enemy forces. But I'd like to go to some other aspect here this morning and talk about how blood clots. And I'll go over to the board. I'll try to draw it as big as I can or large as I can. I hope you can read it. I don't have a slide, otherwise I'd show it. But let's say here is an artery. The two parallel lines. And then we'll say something happens. You cut that artery. So now you have severed that artery, and I'm going to just make it a little wider just for our own illustration. Now what's going to happen? The blood is under pressure. You see, it has to be under pressure to get into the artery from the heart. And then because it's full, that pressure is maintained by the contraction of the walls of the arteries to drive it out to the capillary. I might stop a moment here. Now, when it reaches the capillary has two ends. It has what we call the arterial end. That's coming from carrying the blood from the lungs. And it comes under pressure, and the pressure drops and drops and drops, until on the arterial end of the capillary, the pressure is only maybe 2 or 3 millimeters. Very small. And then it goes through the capillary very slowly, and by the time it comes on the vein end of the capillary, the pressure is almost zero. Maybe a little bit. Now, tell me, how does your blood in the sole of your foot get back up to the heart? It's being pushed under pressure to the capillary, but by the time it's gone through the capillary, it's almost zero pressure. Now, how do you raise a column of blood that gets bigger and bigger and heavier from the sole of your foot to your heart? Which muscles? Someone said, is it muscles? You see, God has so placed our veins that they are either going between muscles, between layers of muscles, and those that are under the skin, they have fibers from the underlying muscles to come up and go over them. And as you contract those muscles, the blood is pushed towards your heart. There are one-way valves periodically put in these veins so that when you compress a vein, the blood can't go back towards the capillary, it goes towards the heart. So, coming up your leg veins, you have these valves. And now the blood has got to your groin. Now there are no more valves from there. The last valve has ended. The big veins in your pelvis and in your abdomen and chest have no valves. How does the blood reach from your groin? How does it get up into your heart? Well, you see, the abdomen and chest and pelvic cavities have supports of some bones, but the rest of it is muscles. You have muscles on the deep end of your pelvis, the lower end, and your anterior abdominal wall and the muscles between your ribs. You see, the diaphragm is also a muscle. So when you take a deep breath, your diaphragm goes down, you increase the pressure in your abdominal and pelvic cavity, and simultaneously you decrease the pressure in your chest cavity. And the blood literally comes up from your groin right into your heart. When your diaphragm goes down, the abdominal muscles are contracted to hold it, so the pressure within your abdomen and pelvis is increased, and it's decreased here, so the blood just shoots right up into the heart. Now, I have often watched this. Maybe I shouldn't tell you naughty things I do, but I'm in church. And sometimes I look and I see a choir up above, and all the time they are fidgeting. All of us, people, you look around here, you're fidgeting all the time. Your legs are moving, your arms are moving. You're circulating your venous blood. When we're in bed, we're shifting our position all night long. And you know, when two people sleep together, after a while they begin to shift in unison. One triggers the other. But that is physiological. Now, if you thrash around, maybe that isn't. That's pathological. But normally, even in good sound sleep, we are moving all the time. Now, here the blood pours out. The blood comes out. You cut the artery. Now, the next step, this is number one. Let's put this number one. Now number two, and we won't show both ends of the artery here, we'll just show this end here. Immediately an artery is cut, two things happen. The cut end draws in the other direction. It draws towards the artery, towards where the blood is coming from. And while it draws back in this direction, the lining of the artery wrinkles. It retracts. So you see, we have two things here. We have retraction, and then soon after it has retracted, the end of the artery will contract. So it becomes smaller. Now, why do you think it does that? To slow the flow of blood. But the blood is still flowing out here, but maybe not quite as much. That's step number two. Now, step number three, the artery has retracted a bit and it has contracted a bit. So we'll draw it this way. Liberated from the damaged cells are chemicals that make the platelets. The platelets are tiny, we can call them cells or fragments of cells that are circulating all the time in the blood. And these platelets that are circulating in the blood are activated by the chemicals released by the cut cells or the damaged cells, and they get sticky. And so now these little platelets begin to stick at the cut end of the artery. The same thing is happening at this end too, but I'm just showing this end. Blood is still coming out here, flowing out. But the platelets now are sticking. That's the third step. Now the fourth step is the platelets are sticking on here. The platelets become very sticky themselves. And so as the red and white blood cells are flowing through that cut end, these begin to stick to the platelets. And the blood is now, very little blood is flowing out. Now there is a protein that's in the plasma of the blood called fibrinogen. Fibrinogen. And it too becomes activated by these tissue juices, or the juices that are liberated from damaged cells, and the platelets now are breaking apart as well. They get sticky, the red blood cells and others stick to them, and now this protein that is fibrinogen turns to fibrin. It's converted to fibrin. And the word suggests a fiber. This protein forms strands like a spider's web. And so in this you get various of these strands of protein. So now we have here a clot. We call that a clot. Now what happens to the blood when you get a clot? The blood stops flowing. And then within about probably 20 to 30 minutes, now you see we've got it like this. We have the wrinkled lining. We have the white blood cells and the red blood cells and the platelets that have all stuck there. And at the other end, the same thing is happening on the cut end. Now I drew it apart, but we'll say there's another end here. And here these fibers of fibrin go all the way across both of the clots, the two ends. And about 30 minutes later, the fibrin begins to shrink. And it pulls the two ends of the artery back together. And here we call it the clot retraction. Now the most wonderful thing about all this when you consider it is that without blood there would be no healing. That's true of an artery there, it's true of a fractured bone. when a bone fractures, blood comes out of both ends. And the same process goes through. The damaged cells of the bone liberate chemicals that make the platelets sticky. And that enmeshes in them, the red cells and the white cells just all stick together. And then the fibrin comes along, and those same chemicals convert fibrinogen, a protein that's present in our blood all the time. About 1% of the protein in your blood is fibrinogen, just waiting there in case of an accident. And that fibrinogen turns to fibrin, and then the fibrin shrinks and makes the bridge across the separated ends of the artery or the bone. You know, Christ shed His blood for us. And without that shed blood, the wound or severance that was made by sin could never be bridged. It is Christ's shed blood that bridges the gap in the wound that sin made. And we should remember that without the shedding of blood, there is no life. May God help us to thank Him for what He has done for us and to accept His shed blood, that the wound that sin has caused and separated us from our Creator can be bridged and that we can be one with Him. Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we are grateful for the night of rest and sleep that each of us enjoyed and the health and strength and life itself that we have today. And as we have considered the wondrous working of the bodies that Thou hast given us, just here in the blood and the clotting mechanism, and the wonderful illustration it makes of what Thou hast done to heal the wounds that sin has produced, may we give our lives to Thee, and may Thy blood cleanse our pages, and through Thy grace may we be prepared to be reunited with Thee and with one another in Thy eternal kingdom. Is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries have been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.